Welcome to the Abn Abn Podcast, episode 87, a podcast for IT professionals. Hi, I'm Al.
I'm John.
I'm Stu.
And I'm Jerry.
And in this episode, we talk about lined endings in files.
We talk about OpenStack.
We talk about secrets management.
And we also talk about protecting your network. So without further ado, let's get on with the show.
So we're back again for another episode. It's going to be a kind of a feedback episode. We had a couple of emails in, and we've also asked our Telegram channel for some questions. So going straight in it, we've got a feedback from Ian. He says, I hear a lot about OpenStack, but whenever I try to find out stuff about it, I get vague buzzwords laden and vague comments with evangelists. Could any of you guys explain to an IT illiterate, but not a sysadmin end user, what the hell OpenStack is?
Yeah, I'm good for going for that one. I've worked for a little bit before, not in a production scenario, but in a proof of concept. So yeah, OpenStack itself, in a sense, was a bit of an answer to things like AWS and Azure back in the around 2010. I think it came out in first place. And what it was a way of essentially having your own cloud, but on your own machinery. So rather than going to AWS and saying, I want this virtual machine, I want this firewall, you would actually create your own cloud, essentially, on your own hardware. So say you've got rack space already, you've got a load of servers, but rather than having to install an OS from scratch every time, you could use it as if it was another cloud provider. So you could spin up a virtual machine quite quickly and use techniques like CloudInit, which can bring up do first-time configuration on a machine quite quickly. It's got built-in firewalls in there. And it's all built upon KVM, which is the Linux virtual machine stack. So it means that it's all done at the hardware level at that point. And also, you can use things like Terraform to configure it as well. So it does feel a bit like a cloud. The reason a lot of places started to get into it, as I say, was a bit of an answer to the cloud, but a lot of the places that took it on recently are more telecommunications companies because they have a lot of rack space in either their exchanges or because they've been going for that many years, they've got a lot of kind of POPs that have point of presence, sorry, and they have a lot of places that have rack space that they can put servers in, already have servers there, but they want to run their own cloud so their data isn't in something like AWS or Azure, and also so they can sell it on. So the ones that were big in creating in the first place were NASA and Rackspace.
Yeah, they started the project off, didn't they?
Yes, and one of the reasons behind that was just, you know, as far as I remember, NASA had a lot of the things like the object storage sides, where it's Rackspace, obviously quite a big server provider and now more of a managed service provider, but they had racks, they wanted to put things in them, and they got quite involved in that side of things as well. I mean, I think one of the reasons it became quite a buzzwordy topic, especially in the mid 2014-2015 kind of time, was as I say, everyone saw the size that the cloud providers were getting to, and not everyone was comfortable with it. So your providers like HP was one of the ones I worked with quite heavily at the time. There was something they called Helion, and that was a distribution of OpenStack. And essentially it was OpenStack that could be installed onto servers, but branded with HP. And also it was customized slightly. So they used Ansible to deploy OpenStack itself. But there's lots of different ways of deploying OpenStack. And the problem is every different distribution had a different way of doing it.
Yeah.
And one of the big problems they had with it was the upgrade path. That up until around 2015, 2016, when I was still working with it, there was still no defined upgrade path from version to version. Because one of the ways that a lot of, like Rackspace, the way they wanted to go about it was rather than upgrading the existing hardware, they would deploy new racks, put new hardware in it, put it in the latest version of OpenStack, move all the virtual machines, all the firewalls that have been configured on OpenStack, all of that kind of thing, and move it over to the new hardware that's in the new racks, and then decommission the old one. They'd just do it on a rolling rack basis rather than, you know, upgrading in place. And yeah, a few years ago, as I say, a lot of the telecoms providers started to get really into it because they had the space, they were able to make use of it and resell the space. And they've kind of steered the direction of it to be very networking focused in some places. You know, some of the networking side of the OpenStack deployments, especially the software-defined networking stages, so where you can say how you want your network to act, how you want it across multiple servers, that kind of thing. All of that started to be driven a lot by the telecommunications providers, at which point it became very, very focused on how an ISP would want to run it rather than actually, you know, as an end user or an enterprise would be trying to use it. And this isn't to say OpenStack's a bad thing, but it's not quite got the same buzz that it used to because it seems to be co-opted a little bit by telecommunications providers. There is a few clouds that actually run it as their way of deploying machines. So rather than, you know, AWS, it's slightly, you know, a black box as to how they're doing things. Yes, they say how it works, but you don't get to see the nitty-gritty of it. There's a few providers that actually say up front, we use OpenStack to provide our cloud. So OVH is one, and then Huawei, their cloud is all based upon OpenStack as well. And there's a few others like that, but not as far as I'm aware, none of the big clouds use it. So AWS, they definitely don't. Azure, they definitely don't. Google, definitely don't. After that, not 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure most of them don't. But when you get to some of the, don't want to say niche, but slightly, you know, more regional ones, they tend to be coming from an OpenStack side of things just because it was an easy way to spin up a cloud that you could then resell to other people. And yeah, it doesn't have the same buzz that it had a few years ago just because AWS nowadays is so easy to use. And yes, it can be a bit pricey, but it's almost become the de facto way of using things, whereas actually building your own and the complexity that comes with it, I think a lot of people just went, no, I'm not going to do this.
You mentioned HP had an OpenStack environment. The company that I work for, Fujitsu, they also had an OpenStack environment. And I did quite a lot of work with that around the 2017, 2018 mark. And like you said, it's predominantly, it's infrastructures as a service. So virtual machines, block storage and networking, and quite key is image storage as well. So you'd have your block storage for your disks. You'd have an image storage, which is like an object storage thing as well. So when you deploy your machine, you say, create a virtual disk image using this virtual machine image. But like you said as well, upgrades was difficult. So you mentioned before as well about how lots of different solutions providers would build an environment with the intention being that they would then build a second environment sitting alongside it and shift over to that. We actually had custom routing code to be able to create multiple availability zones and things like that. And custom routers to join those two availability zones together, which you couldn't do with raw OpenStack. And when they went to do the upgrade, I think I'm outside of NDRs now. When they went to do the upgrade, there was a problem because the routing code that they were using wouldn't backport. So you couldn't lift that routing code from the version we were using, which was probably the 2016 release of OpenStack, to the 2018 version of OpenStack, for example.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I found quite interesting with OpenStack was that Ubuntu made a lot of noise about OpenStack, but SUSE, company behind SUSE, whoever it was at the time, were actually going around and buying a lot of the OpenStack companies and environments. So you mentioned Helium by HP. SUSE actually bought, or the company that owned SUSE, bought the HP Helium release.
Yeah.
To basically, and they were going around, they were buying up a few different providers, effectively to make it so that when you thought OpenStack, you thought SUSE. What I have noticed is that SUSE are now following the same path with Kubernetes things. So they've just recently bought Rancher, who make quite a few tools around Kubernetes, which I think is a very interesting play from them, because I think that that's their intention, is to say, if you want Kubernetes, you come to us, in the same way that they were saying, if you want OpenStack, you come to us.
Yeah.
I was going to say, actually, it sounds like a lot of the problems that OpenStack was built to solve are now solved by Kubernetes, as long as you run containers, obviously. Maybe you need a private cloud to install Kubernetes on. OpenStack comes in there, maybe. But yeah, I'd say that a lot of people would now sort of reach for Kubernetes rather than reach for OpenStack.
Yeah, so I suppose one of the interesting things about that is there is now a project called KubeVirt, which will run virtual machines created by Kubernetes. So actually, it might actually occupy the same space now as what OpenStack did. And I suppose a point on the SUSE thing as well, I think it was late last year, there was SUSE actually officially announced that they would no longer be supporting any OpenStack in terms of, you know, if they've got active contracts, they would be, but they wouldn't be doing any more new releases, any more support for it. So essentially, they've now themselves stopped dealing with OpenStack as well. So yeah, it's, as I say, it's not quite got the same luster that it used to.
So a couple of things on this. It looks, looking at back at our episode list, it looks like we talked about OpenStack in episode 51. So if anyone wants to go back and have a listen to that. And also, my other thought on this, just as a sort of end user of cloud stuff, is I guess, in fact, I'm pretty sure that you can use Terraform with it. In fact, you might have said earlier, Stu, sorry. Yeah, so it's got the Terraform provider, just like all the other clouds. And I think there's like a command line tool as well, like AZCLI or AWSCLI, where you can just talk to the API that OpenStack presents.
Yeah, so there's an interesting little quirk around that. If you have got the OpenStack, let's say for sake of argument, I don't know what the lettering is up to now, but when we were looking at it, Okta, I think O was the most recent release. So if you've created an OpenStack environment based around Okta, or Okta, I can't remember what it was, but O, the O release of it, and your cloud moves to the OPQR, let's say they've moved to T release, there's a chance that some of those scripts may or may not work. There's a chance that some of the tooling around, you know, how you import things or consume certain features may not work. Depending on, and because OpenStack is very modular, in the same way that Kubernetes is exceptionally modular, you're not bound to specific components because it's basically gluing all these bits together. Depending on what components you're using inside your environment, will change the tool, well, what commands you can run with the tools. So if in your O environment, you've got piece A, B, C, and D, and when you then go to the T release, you've gone, well, okay, we still need A and B, but let's go with F and G instead for the, you know, the networking and the security products in there. It means that a lot of your tools stop working. And even worse, the environment that my employer had and that HP had as well, I think, because they were customized, yes, there are Terraform modules, but they didn't work consistently with all of these deployments because it wasn't a standard platform. So like I said, we'd created availability zones in the various regions that we'd deployed to, and that wasn't a part of native OpenStack. So we had our own Ansible modules. In fact, the Ansible modules that my employer were using were actually written by one of our audience and myself and a couple of other people worked on it as well, but it was predominantly the two of us that were working on it. We had similar stuff going with the Terraform modules. They were created by a team in India because the native Terraform modules just didn't work with the OpenStack that we had.
Yeah, I suppose that was one of the things out of the modularity as well. It meant that quite easily a component of it could be replaced by something that they decided was now what superseded it. And so you now have a new project that, say, provides networking or a new project that provides identity, at which point what was the project that you were targeting before might not actually be the same project anymore to provide, I don't know, authentication or something. One thing that is quite interesting about the modularity, though, is place I used to work at, they didn't run OpenStack, but they did use the Swift side, which is just the object storage. So Amazon's S3 is object storage where rather than, you know, being given a block of a hard drive to put files on. It is just a bucket that you put files in. You're not actually presented the drive itself. And OpenStack Swift is another object storage provider, but it means you can run it yourself. And yeah, as I say, a place I worked at didn't want the entire OpenStack full suite, but they did want object storage, so they could take that bit and only use that bit, which was quite an interesting use of it, I found.
I have seen there's another project similar to S3 called Eucalyptus.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure whether that's a full replacement for EC2 plus S3 or if it's just an S3 compatible layer. But yeah, there is a thing called Eucalyptus, which is effectively an API re-implementation of S3.
Interesting.
Going back to your talk about SUSE a little while ago, I've been listening to the Coda radio thing on Juniper Broadcasting. And what they keep having a discussion about if anyone using OpenSUSE or SUSE in production. What are they going about, like the black, the dark matter? They keep going about dark matter engineering or something, or that's completely just gone?
I think the dark matter thing is rather than people that are working in the open source world. So, you know, if you contribute to a project in open source, people will see that. I think the entire point behind dark matter is to say that these are things that are happening, but no one ever gets to see them if you're not actually working in that company. So,
okay. You know,
there's certain things where I am that will never see the light of day and the same previous places because they're not really supposed to be open sourced. And I mean, I suppose in some ways that any place that creates proprietary software would essentially kind of in a way be a dark matter enterprise. But I think it's also the ones that create their own internal applications that never see the light of day as well. So, yeah, it's the ones that aren't ever seen in a way, yeah.
So they're basically taking open source, using it internally and changing it, but then obviously not pushing it back out into
that. Yeah, that or just creating the applications themselves. And again, it's technically their own source code, but it never sees the light of day outside of that company. So it, in a way, what they make, no one but themselves and the company gets to see it. So yeah, in a way, that is dark matter, I guess.
And interesting, they keep going about Linode as well. I mean, I never really used Linode before. I think you have, Jerry, haven't you?
Yeah, in fact, I've got a freelance project going on at the moment. I would say we've had this conversation on the Telegram channel. It's got a few things missing that make it that make it a less good cloud provider, in my opinion. And mainly that's cloud in it, which is I think Stu mentioned a few minutes ago. You configure the server when it first boots, your VM when it first boots. So you can give it like a script, or you can run Ansible or whatever when it first boots. And then if you're using an immutable infrastructure paradigm, you don't do anything else to the VM once it's up, so you do everything on that first boot. Linode doesn't have that, and the other thing is that it doesn't have much. You can't image a machine, so you can't configure a machine, take an image of it and store it. Or you can, but you can only do that for 3 images, and they have to be 6 gigabytes, kind of compressed 6 gigabytes. So that doesn't leave you much elbow room. What the sort of bigger cloud providers do is they charge you to store those images and in the object storage usually. So they can make money out of you storing images. But Linode just don't allow you to store more than 3. So in that way, it's a bit limiting. I found this out because I tried to do that immutable, you know, building an image first and then storing it. And then I found out about the limitations, and I thought I had to look at the approach I was using again. So I'd say, I mean, for a cheap cloud provider, we're not sponsored by them, but I'd still say DigitalOcean because it has those features, which are pretty important in my opinion.
Good. I think we've got feedback from Jay. I think, do you want to go for that, John? Because I think he was commenting what you mentioned last time about when we're using Git and Visual Code and issues you're having.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the last podcast, I mentioned that I was having issues with VS Code in Windows, saying that, just to put some context on this, VS Code is the short version of Visual Studio Code, which is the Microsoft code editor that everyone's tending to prefer at the moment, I would say. And you can either run Visual Studio Code in Windows, Mac or Linux. But if you're running it on Windows, you can also do what they call a connection, a remote connection to the Windows subsystem for Linux environment. So this is what I do. I tend to open Visual Studio Code in my Windows environment, but then I'll open up a terminal in Windows subsystem for Linux, predominantly because I'm running things like Ansible and Terraform. And so I said last time that I'm getting state issues between what Git thinks is currently modified in Windows and in Visual Studio Code versus what Git thinks is modified in the Windows subsystem for Linux environment. And so what Jay said, in your last podcast, somebody mentioned having issue with VS Code in Windows, always saying that the files were all edited. What's probably going wrong is the wrong setting for the core.autocrlf setting. You can fix it by opening PowerShell in Windows and running git config --global --core.autocrlf --input. So that's git config --global --core.autocrlf --input. And it says there are three settings, but I always recommend the input one as it converts everything to LF line endings on commit and checks out without modification. So firstly, yes, that is very interesting and very probably the issue that I've got. So effectively what's happening is that there are three different types of line endings. Linux file systems use exclusively LF, which stands for line feed, which is a control character. I think it's control 13, character 13 in the ASCII sequence. So that's the line feed, the LF character sequence. You also got carriage return, CR, which is ASCII character 10. So Windows uses CR, so character 10, LF, character 13, to basically say that this is the end of a line of ASCII text. And ASCII is basically just a way of storing and recording lines of text. The final line ending type is actually on Mac, and I'm not sure whether it's current Mac or it's old Mac, where it would use just the CR carriage return. So you've got these three different line endings, Windows, Mac, and Linux. And because there's these three different file endings, Git tries to be sensible. Well, Git has got different states. It can either say, I will be sensible about this file ending, and I will assume that it's always a line feed, it's always a carriage return, or I'll just guess based on what the operating system is that I'm working on. So what it can do is it can say, well, you've committed it as a line feed, but you're on a Windows system, so I'll change all of those line feeds when I clone it. When I copy it from the repository to your file system, I will change all of the line feed lines to carriage return line feed CRLF. And then when you try and make a commit back, I'll then take all of the CRLF lines and replace them with LFs. I'm not really sure how I feel about this because I kind of work predominantly on Windows, but I'm also using the Windows subsystem for Linux. Sometimes I'll be working on a file that is using, that needs that carriage return line feed, the Windows file endings. It's not often, but there's occasions when I do, and I kind of need to not think about those line feed endings when I'm working on those types of files. And likewise, when I'm working on Linux, I kind of don't want to think about what the line endings are. So if I'm predominantly working on something that I know is going to end up in Linux, I'll just use the Windows subsystem for Linux and just use the git commands in there. If I'm know it's only ever going to be working on Windows, then I'll use the Windows Windows environment. And in fact, actually what I'm tending to do nowadays is actually use PowerShell for anything that's on my Windows environment. And when I'm using something that will be in Linux, I'm using that remote Windows subsystem for Linux connection rather than just opening a Windows subsystem for Linux terminal in the Windows environment, just to kind of give my editor a chance to actually think about things in the right way, and also to try and give myself the mental headspace that that's how I'm working on it. Does that all make sense so far? There is one other thing that Jay's mentioned, so I just want to check that I'm up. Everyone's okay with where I'm up to with that.
So you work on an Ansible file. Are you saving it inside a WSL? Or are you saving it inside of a on your local Windows machine, which is then outside the Linux file system?
Right.
I haven't come across this problem yet, but I'm only doing my Terraform code, and that's saved on my Windows box. But when I'm doing my Ansible code, I have a folder, the Git clone of my repository in my home folder, which is so it thinks it's a Linux kind of thing.
Right. So this is probably down to how I'm doing Windows subsystem for Linux entirely wrong. I use a particular file structure for all of the things that I work on. So because I know that my documents folder is backed up through various corporate processes, I have a folder in my documents called 01 projects. So that means it's at the top of my directory structure. And I've got other folders. So I think 30 or something like that is where I put all of the training stuff that I write. And 35 is all the training stuff that I consume. And then 90 something is all of HR processes and stuff like that. They all end up in all these different folders. So it means that when I'm looking for a file, I can just quickly drop into one or two folders. And then inside those, I store stuff in year, month, date, dash, and then the project that I'm working on or the thing that I'm working on that pertains to. So because I have this directory structure that's quite organized and is, I know, is backed up, what I've done in my Windows subsystem for Linux environment is I have a symbolic link from my home directory to my documents folder. So /home/John in Windows subsystem for Linux has a symbolic link from the documents directory to my user directory in Windows. So let's say, for sake of argument, my username, not wishing to give away any too many secrets, but my username is, let's say, John. It's not, but it's, let's say it's John. So in WSL, it's /home/John/documents is a symbolic link to /mount/c/user/John/documents. So that then means that, so if I open up File Explorer, navigate to that documents folder, go into projects, and then the thing that I'm working on at that time, and open that folder in Windows subsystem for Linux. When I then open up a WSL bash prompt, which is one of the shells that you can open, that is then a WSL bash in mount c users john documents blah blah blah. If I then cd tilde, which takes me back to my home directory, so /home/John, and then cd documents, then I'm in the same directory structure. So this is probably where I'm doing it wrong. What I should really be doing is only having stuff to do with version controlled stuff in my Windows subsystem for Linux environment, and then having anything that runs in Windows accessed from the Windows file tree. And then when I need to back stuff up, actually manually back it up or push it into our version control system. Does that make sense, Stu? Al, even?
Yeah, it does.
I use that symbolic link trick with Windows subsystem for Linux, but that's because I'm probably one of the few holdouts on code and I tend to do everything in Vim. So if I download a file, I want to have quick access to that, even if I'm on a Windows machine, at which point I will just open up Windows subsystem for Linux and then just open the file up in Vim in my downloads directory, which is actually my Windows downloads directory, not my one on the Windows subsystem for Linux side. It's just, yeah, as I say, I'm a bit of a holdout on that one. I'm still trying to get into code, but yeah, Vim is still the one I tend to go for all the time.
For me, I've got everything in the Linux environment, and it's not actually backed up from my laptop, but I just make sure I commit everything that I need committing. But I do need to change it, but, you know, it takes time and thought, so I haven't done it yet. I just wanted to follow up on line feed and carriage return and just go very quickly into the origins of it. They both come from typewriters. So a line feed is when you just sort of turn the wheel to feed the paper through to get to the next line, and a carriage return is the classic bell when it goes from the end of one line to the beginning of the next line. So, and that's because the original Unix systems were using teletypes, basically typewriters, to actually input the commands. So a bit of trivia there.
Fab. So the other thing that Jay mentions is that he's recently created a video series explaining literally step by step how you get from somebody going into a web browser and typing a page on a web server in a web browser, how everything from the DNS request is made, how the TCP packet is formed, how that goes over the IP stack, how the web server processes the request. And it's literally, it goes into a massive amount of detail. I think it's something like 6 or 7, maybe even 8 episodes on that video stream in the video series. It's on YouTube, I think. I've watched the first episode and a half, I think it is. I do need to spend some time looking at it. I was talking to the guys on the pre-show about what I've been involved in the last couple of weeks, and I just haven't had a chance to look at it. But it is a fantastic, does look like a fantastic and really well-researched set of videos. So that's going to be in the show notes for people to go and have a look at. And also a link to the page that Jay also mentioned, which is how to customize your Git configuration for formatting and white space, because that was a really good piece of feedback. So thank you very, very much, Jay. It was very much appreciated.
We'll have to go and binge that.
It looks really good. It looks really, really good. So that's our second bit of feedback.
Cool.
So the other thing that we did in the last couple of weeks is actually put out a call for questions to our Telegram group. And we've had a couple of people come back, so we're going to see how well we do, because we've gone a little bit longer on those two pieces of feedback than I thought we were. Surprise, surprise, we talked a bit. So the first question was from WIE space E, who's one of our Telegram community members, and he has asked us for some help looking at secrets management in continuous integration and continuous delivery or deployment systems. So Jerry and possibly Stu, I think you're more likely to have done this than I am. Do either of you want to start having a talk about that?
Yeah, I can do a little bit on that. I've actually been doing a fair bit of that recently. So the main issue that you get with secrets management in a continuous integration, continuous deployment system. So examples would potentially be Jenkins is one used for continuous integration. GitLab CI is also another alternative on that side as well. And you've got all sorts of different tools that can manage your delivery. Secrets themselves, if you don't, you're trying to avoid committing them to along with your code, so that if for whatever reason your code is compromised, it doesn't have actual credentials in there that could then be used to compromise your network at that point. So the idea behind secrets management is to say have something where they're encrypted, or there's a method to get hold of the secrets without necessarily having the secrets stored in the code itself. And there's a few ways of going about it. So in something like Jenkins or GitLab, you do have the ability to place environment variables in the either your pipeline or in the configuration for your repository so that they're accessible to jobs inside of there. And depending on which one you're using, depends on the level of encryption that you get, the complexity of how it's stored as well. I know recently from using GitLab, it has the ability to use masked variables. So that means that you could put in, say, a username, and that would appear in the output for your continuous integration job. But your password or your token, whatever you use, whether it's an API token or something similar, that would not appear in the output. It would still be stored within your CI system, but it wouldn't be shown in any of the logs or the output or anything like that. So that's at least a way around that. Taking that step further, though, you can start using things like HashiCorp's Vault, or Amazon have something called Secrets Manager, or there's multiple applications that use it. And we've talked to about a couple of them before, but the idea being with something like Vault, for example, rather than having the credentials directly in your code, what you have is a kind of a secret that gives you access to Vault, and then you can pull down the credentials from there. So it's a bit of an extra step to get there. And you can also store the secret that you get to Vault in your continuous integration system. So again, if you're using a master variable in something like GitLab, that wouldn't be exposed in the output for your logs, that kind of thing. And then it means you can talk to something like HashiCorp's Vault to get the your secrets. So, you know, whether it's a database connection string, whether it's just, you know, an API token, it means you don't have to store it directly in the code you got somewhere else. And then these usually have things like encryption at rest and just strong encryption so that, you know, it's really hard to get hold of them secrets. Another thing Vault has is the ability to something called sealing and unsealing. So it means that if you at any point get an inkling of someone is actually getting access to that, that they shouldn't, you can actually seal the vault so no one can actually access it without a number of components of the original key. So Vault has what's called 5 unseal keys, and you need it to input at least 3 of them to unseal it again. So you could take, you know, one person has access to one part of the vault unsealing key, another person has another access. So it means that it takes up to 3 people to be able to unlock it again. So, you know, yes, it's going to take some time to do so, but at least, you know, it's more protected and there's not the ability for one person to have, you know, all the keys to the kingdom, be able to get all of it at once. The problem you tend to find with something like HashiCorp's Vault is it's actually quite complex to set up. I'll go back on that. Getting it set up isn't difficult. The policies and some of what they call the secrets engines inside, which are how to store your secrets, are a little more difficult to manage. And just getting your head around some of the terminology can take some doing. But once you've worked with it for a little while, Vault's actually a really nice way of doing it. But as I say, it does take a bit of manual management. And then, as I say, things like AWS's secrets management actually in some ways take that step a little bit further, because rather than having to store, say, a secret that gets you to Vault and then that will give you your secret back, in AWS there's something called a role. And if you have that role, you can access that secret. You don't have to store anything inside of your code. That role is actually tied to your application itself once it's deployed, not actually in the code. And it just means that you can say, I have this role, I'm allowed to see this secret and what's inside it. Again, whether it's database connection string or similar. And it means that you don't have to store anything in your code to be able to view that. But the problem there is if you then move to another cloud provider or you want to use your application elsewhere, they don't have the same access at that point because you're not within AWS's environment. So it does kind of depend where you're running it. If you're doing everything entirely on-prem, something like HashiCorp's Vault is a good place to look for it. If you're, you know, in one of the cloud providers and you're, you know, you're quite wedded to that provider, you're not thinking you're going to, you know, move, you know, you're in Azure and you're going to move to GCP next week or something like that. If you're, you know, you think you're going to be in that cloud for the long term, actually looking at some of their managed services makes the management easier because you don't have to think about how you manage the secrets, how you open the vaults. You don't have to worry about any of that. It's just, I have a role, I can view this secret. Anyone else doesn't have that role, so they can't see the secret.
Just a quick sort of alternative take on this. Wouldn't necessarily work in all cases, but what you can do is to generate a random string for a password in your provisioning code, so Ansible or Terraform, and you can say to the database, this is your password, and you can then pass that variable into the machine that needs to access the database, for instance. And so you put the password in the configuration for the app or for whatever that's accessing the database, and you tell the database that's the password, and the password never needs to be stored in any vaults or anything. It's stored in, you know, in the database software and in the configuration file that needs to access the database. So that allows you to rotate passwords and so on for those things that need passwords and not something like a key.
So how does that work then?
So, I mean, if you were doing it in Ansible, for instance, I think it's the password module. You can tell it to just create a random string. And then you tell your MySQL database, for instance, that that's the password for a given user. And then you put that same string into the file that manages the database access.
So effectively you have a per machine, per application password. Is that right? So then if you've got 5 machines, machine 1 might have a username, machine 1 with a password of, you know, ABCDEF. And then machine two might have, you know, decaf bad, and machine three might have dead cow or something like that. The three different passwords. Mm. So that when you then demise machine one, you completely remove that machine's credentials. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's more that, right, these are the database credentials to the database. These are the credentials for this user. To the application, here's the username and password. Stick that in the configuration file, and the password is generated on the fly, and it's given to both pieces at the same time.
Ah, so it's never, so very effectively, so it's never stored in your config.
Yeah, and it's never, and it, there's no need to store it in a vault or anything like that, because it's where it needs to be, and it never has to be known to anyone, and therefore can never be compromised. Well, unless you compromise the database machine or the machine with the app.
I suppose as an extension of that, potentially, as well as some of the cloud providers now offer the ability to not even have to provide usernames and passwords because they have the concept of roles. I talk a lot about AWS. It's the one I've got the most experience with, but I know in AWS now, if you've got a role, you can now talk to one of their managed databases without needing to supply username and password just because it's got that role, as long as the application that's talking is aware that it's in AWS and is talking to an AWS endpoint. It knows that it doesn't actually need to supply username and password anymore. It's got the role that will do it instead. So that can simplify some of the secrets management as well, depending on what, you know, where it's deployed.
You have that in Azure as well, and it's actually quite advanced and, you know, fairly easy to use, where VMs have, well, they can have an identity. It's called a system assigned identity, and that is essentially the same as an instance role in AWS, and you can say, right, this, it's a GUID, it's, you know, it's a UUID, and then you just say that this UUID has access to this Azure resource, and off you go. And it, but it also takes it one step further, where you can create an identity, which is its own resource, and you can assign that identity to anything, basically. So a VM, you can assign it to a VM, or you know, anything that needs to access another bit of Azure from itself, and that stops you having to, like you say, provide a credentials file to do that. So it's just done through the Azure IAM system, which is basically Active Directory.
Is that managed identities then you're talking?
Yeah, yeah. So there's two types of system assigned, which is the ones that come with the VM, or I think AKS has it as well, the Kubernetes, Azure Kubernetes.
Yeah, because I've been using that a lot for accessing certificates. So we've got a number of web apps which needs access to certificates, and you create a managed identity.
So the certificates themselves are held in Key Vaults, I assume?
Yes, they are.
Yeah, so, and then that's slightly different, I think, because Key Vaults have access policies where you give them a list of service principles, which is what they are in Azure, which is like, it's basically, comes down to like a user, but it can be, it doesn't have to be like an Azure user, it can be an application as well. But that, that's slightly different from the IAM stuff. But it uses the same identities and so on. So you say that a Key Vault, these identities are allowed this access, and then off you go. Whereas the IAM stuff is more like, these identities can have the ability to do this to this bit of Azure. So there's a subtle difference there. But yeah, it's quite powerful. It comes down to Azure Active Directory, which is something that obviously Windows admins would be quite comfortable with.
I suppose the answer to the original question is going to be, it depends, really, doesn't it?
It's a very big subject.
Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, are you willing to run something like HashiCorp's Vault yourself? Are you in a cloud provider? Are you just wanting passwords to be created on the fly and use them that way? Yeah. Unfortunately, there's no easy, this is the way to do it. It's just that there's many ways. And yeah, it's going to take a lot of research as to which one actually is the one you want to go for, really.
Yeah, I'm guessing, just going back as well, why you want to do it. Because you were saying about obviously storing password in your source control, isn't it? That's what you're trying to get away from, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So
yeah.
is people can search for them, can't they?
Yeah, I mean, even if it's in a private repository or something like that, it might be private to your organization, but if someone manages to compromise your organization, they can potentially get hold of that one, whereas if it's not stored there at all, it's going to be a lot harder to get hold of it. So yeah,
how many people got like read-only access to your repositories kind of thing, then they're going to get access to that, aren't they?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, all it takes is one person to either have their machine compromised or to be a malicious insider, you know, and potentially those credentials are then compromised for going forwards. And they, and also, this was something that the Matrix.org project had, was where they had what they considered to be a secured machine that had a Jenkins service running on there. And there was a flaw on that Jenkins instance. But it, because it was a public Jenkins instance, so that people could see that the builds were transparently building and they were building what was in the source repositories. When that Jenkins machine was compromised, an attacker got into that Jenkins machine and then was able to, via a lot of, unfortunately, bad choices were made with the security of that host. They were actually able to then pivot through the rest of the network. So yes, all it takes is one machine or one service potentially being compromised, and you could potentially let people into other parts of your network.
It's worth saying that the CI/CD machine is very sensitive to attacks and so on. So
yes.
Yeah, try and keep the secrets away from that if you can.
Yeah.
And do the secrets management elsewhere. And also make it only possible to access through a VPN, which I believe is quite a neat segue onto our next talking point.
Well, indeed. So one of our community members, a guy called Yannick, he's actually asked us two questions, and they kind of quite neatly mesh together. The first question was, should you have an always-on VPN or not? And the second part is, how do you protect your target network? Because obviously any machine in that network could be the weakest link in the network. So what should you do to protect your network? So I've got some thoughts on this. I thought I would see what you guys think first, and then I will tell you where you're wrong, because that's obviously, you know, that's the way that I roll. So any thoughts on this one, first of all? The silence is deafening. Excellent. Right, okay. So it's down to me to answer this one. Fantastic. Okie dokie. So always on VPN. I have had always on VPN with my work machines. I have tried doing that with my phones in the past. And generally, my view is that on a machine where you are consistently accessing resources, so for example, the work machine that I have is consistently accessing work resources. So things like Active Directory, SharePoint, file stores, remote desktop servers, things like that. If you are consistently going in and out of those environments, then you should have an always-on VPN. If you are only accessing services in an ad hoc basis, having an always-on VPN is not a good idea, because effectively it means that if you imagine that your network has a bubble around it, and you put your security things on the edge of those bubbles, so your firewalls that you might have used in the past, your proxies and things like that, it's kind of like a fortress mentality. If you have an always-on VPN, it means that bubble has just grown to include your end user device. So that means that when I'm using my work computer on my home network, which a lot of us are doing at the moment, because obviously lots of people are working from home now, it means that the other devices in my home network, potentially, if they were compromised, could have access through my machine. So if there was something that had, you know, if I had weak credentials on my machine, for example, if I was running an insecure service or a service that had vulnerabilities on it, effectively, I am permitting access from other devices in my network through to my work network. My work machine is a hardened machine, but that's because of the nature of the work that I do. So in theory, we don't have open ports. We don't have running services that are not required for my day job. So therefore, in theory, the always on VPN on my work machine is a good idea. My mobile phone, on the other hand, I probably would not ever run an always on VPN with that, because effectively I only need to access protected resources from that mobile device on an ad hoc basis. So on those instances where I need to access, say, for example, I have a VPN from my mobile phone to my home network. So for when I'm out of the house, if I want to access a file server at home, I will connect the VPN to access the file server. When I'm done, I will disconnect it, because I don't know if I'm on, say, a pub Wi-Fi and it's not protected from traffic from between the different people on that pub network. Potentially, I'm letting anyone that's in that pub come through my phone, if there was, again, an insecure service on my phone, through to my home network. So that's what I think about always on VPNs. Any negative responses to that one?
Are we talking about always on VPN? The way I saw you meaning, was you thinking, like, do you have your VPN, if you have an IPsec site-to-site tunnel, do you have it open all the time or only when traffic flows through it? That's how I thought he was asking the question.
Interesting.
Because I was sort of, if you were saying your way, I was sort of a client VPN versus a site-to-site VPN. But that's just how I was reading the question. Or that's what I thought.
So in my mind, a site-to-site VPN will only ever establish itself when one of the ends has traffic to flow over it. My previous experience with things like Checkpoint, Fortinet, Juniper VPN appliances, they will only raise a new tunnel when traffic is flowing down it, particularly phase two. Phase one, the tunnels may come up and may only stay up for a longer period, but IPsec VPN tunnels have two components to them. You've got the outside tunnel, which effectively joins, let's say, your left to your right machine. And behind your left and your right machines are what we call the encryption domain. It's the interesting traffic. So if you've got 10 subnets behind your left-hand machine and 5 subnets behind your right-hand machine, effectively what you end up with is 50 connections from your left to your right, because each of those 10 networks on the left will have an independent connection to one of those 5 networks on the right. If only one of those networks on the left is talking to one of those networks on the right, even though you've got your broader phase one tunnel, which connects your left to your right, there will be a secondary phase two tunnel, which connects that one subnet from the left to that one subnet on the right. And they have an expiry time on them. So after X amount of minutes, that tunnel will die and will go away unless it's renewed by something. At least that's my impression. Stu, as a resident network engineer, is that your experience of IPsec?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, you've got things like, in the Cisco world, there's what they call dynamic multipoint VPNs, which work on a very similar technology, but are almost providing dynamic access rather than, you know, a dedicated site-to-site link. It can be from a, you know, random sites that can be turned up and down ad hoc. But more or less, it works on a similar basis, just, you know, IPsec but behind the scenes, and maybe you switch your router off at some point, at which point VPN will never come up. But otherwise, once it comes up, it carries on in that same manner, yeah.
Al, does that answer the way that you were looking at the question then?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I used to find that in the older days, like, talking 10, 15 years ago, when the firewalls weren't that powerful, it was a lot of commutes. It was like a lot of calculation, wasn't it, to bring up and down those tunnels a lot, wasn't it?
No, that does make sense. So yeah, so you're right.
Because it doesn't the channels, when it first communicates, when it changes the key, that's when it obviously, you'd used to get ASAs or PICs with certain, like the mass co-presses inside them, wasn't it, which used to do all that work for you. It obviously isn't what you get these days.
Yeah, well, I know a lot of the things like the Intel chipsets nowadays have onboard encryption acceleration anyway, so it means that a lot of that can be offloaded to the processor without actually any impact on, you know, the CPU having to ramp up because it's doing encryption. It'll actually just do it in kind of like a co-processor, but I think it's just a built-in instruction set in a lot of Intel and potentially AMD CPUs now as well.
But yeah, you're right. Certainly the older CPUs would have had to have done more effort to negotiate the keys. You know, typically there would be a DES, triple DES, or AES key exchange. You might have been looking at something like a Diffie-Hellman key exchange as well. And if people are wondering why I'm not going into a lot of detail about the cryptography side of things, is because, as has been discussed in the past, I know the terms, I can't necessarily explain them very well. But effectively, AES, DES, triple DES, there's also AES 256 and AES 128 as well. These are all encryption tools. Diffie-Hellman is a way of having asynchronous key stuff. So again, talking about your left and your right, the way that the keys are exchanged between the two machines means that your left side will basically generate a number and sign it with its private key, and then pass the result of that private key to the other side, which will sign that key, that number, with its own generated number and return that. And then the two ends, without having sight of each other's secret content, can then generate a shared secret. Ultimately, it's complicated maths, but what happens is, because it's doing this complicated maths, Al's right, some of the older chipsets did struggle with carrying out those mathematical equations. So what you tend to find is that people would extend the length of the key exchanges. They would extend how long it was between a session renewing itself, for example. You would try and have the different sessions renewing at different times so that you didn't have 50 tunnels all trying to come up at once. The other thing as well is that the phase one and phase two both have cryptography going on. So your phase one may have something particularly complex. So for example, you might have your AES 256 and the hashing for that might be SHA-512 or something like that. But then your phase two tunnels might have lower encryption on them because the keys were exchanged in phase one. Ultimately, I've never really looked at the fundamentals of why you would pick one stage or another. What you tend to see now in most deployments is that phase one and phase two will both have the maximum level of security that you can do, because as has been previously mentioned, the Intel CPUs all have these inbuilt functions that can do all this maths for you without having particularly to do intensive computation to get to that point.
Yeah. Going about how you say maths and stuff, I was doing a nice confidence document or a wiki document work the other day about private and public keys. And I was going like, yeah, it's just clever maths kind of thing. Everyone laughed at that. I said, there's no one going to explain how it decrypts and encrypts stuff. Does some magic maths does in the background.
Yeah.
Say any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Yep.
It's a fantastic quote. There is a particularly good YouTube video on Diffie-Hellman key exchange, which is sort of the gold standard for this stuff. It's about using paint, and you can see how the paint mixed on one side and the paint mixed on the other side produces a sort of set of colours that you can pass across. I'm not going to explain it. Visual medium does not work very well. I have form of trying to explain this and failing rather miserably. So I'm not going to go into it, but I will link to the video in the show notes. The other question that Yannick asks, though, is how to protect the target network. And this is where it gets quite interesting. So one of the things that I do is I have worked in the past on accounts that have been audited by UK government. Now, that's not to say that I work on those accounts anymore. To be honest, accounts that have been audited by UK government, I haven't even had sight of in more than 5 years. So the rules and regulations around this stuff have probably all changed rather drastically since then. But government has a standard that they work to, which is that you never manage up. So if you've got a trusted network that you do all of your machine management from. So let's say, for example, that's the only place that you can get to your domain controllers from, for example, is from your management environment. And then, or you would access your, effectively you step down into your environments. So if you've got a management environment, the only way you should be able to access that management environment is from a protected machine. So for example, it will have no listening services, or very few listening services. It should have a VPN that comes on from the moment it's authenticated to, because it's only for accessing secured resources. And you step down from there. So for example, if I want to access a file on the internet, I wouldn't access that from my machine. I would connect into my management environment, and I would then use a dedicated internet browsing machine from inside there. And if I needed to pull a file back, I can then, it's effectively got one-way gates. So you connect into your management environment, you connect into your internet browsing environment, you retrieve the file, and then you create a second connection effectively from your management session to your target machine to pull the file back. However, that is a lot of infrastructure to have in place to manage a small environment. So it doesn't work for everything. But there is some fantastic advice and guidance from the UK's NCSC, which is the National Computer... I'll have to find that part, that the what that is. But NCSC basically is a branch of GCHQ, which is the UK's computer security apparatus.
National Cybersecurity Centre.
There we go. There's some fantastic guidance from NCSC on how to browse down and create these management environments. There's loads of end user guidance around protecting machines and hardening machines for Windows, for Mac, for Ubuntu, for Red Hat, all of these things, Android, iOS, it's all on there. Effectively though, for a home network, the thing that will protect you more than anything else is actually NAT. Well, it's not so much NAT, but it's a router that will only allow specific ingress ports. And what you should do really is only if you've got a machine that you want to keep secure, so like my work machine, should really only be connecting to the router that is behind my general purpose networking router. So it can only go out to the internet through that path of that two machines, because the routers are designed to not allow inbound traffic. It's effectively, it's firewalling off my protected machine from my untrusted network, in the same way that your home network is protected from the untrusted general internet by the firewall that's on that router. If you've got things like Internet of Things devices in your house, for example, Wi-Fi connected power switches, if you've got Wi-Fi connected light bulbs or doorbells, or you've got an internet connected fridge.
Radiator valves.
Indeed. They should all really be on their own, for want of a better phrase, untrusted network. Now, there are some downsides to that, which is that a lot of control software relies on things like broadcasts. So a broadcast is a packet that is sent to the broadcast address on the network. So typically on what we call a /24 or a C-class network. So, 192.168.1.0/24. That's your network. The last IP address in that network, the 255, that's your broadcast address for that network. A lot of management software for IoT stuff sends a discovery packet to that broadcast address, and that packet is sent to all of the connected devices on that network, and that packet will be replied to by your Internet of Things to say, I'm here and this is the thing that I can do. If you've got a separate broadcast domain from your my computer's network from your Internet of Things untrusted network, that broadcast never happens. So this is why, for example, the light switches that I've got, the power switches, sorry, that I've got for my Christmas lights, which are going on at the moment. If I'm not on the same network as those light switches, I can turn them on and off going via internet cloud service. But I can't change things like I can't change the timer. I can't find out how much power particular switch is consuming and stuff like that, because it's you can only access that stuff via that broadcast on the local network. So protecting networks is really hard. It's a lot harder than you'd think. And any time that you want to put something that is less secure into your network, you have to be really careful about how you do it. Now, again, I'm gonna throw this one open to the floor and see it, hear everyone clamour at once. Is there anything in there that I've missed?
I suppose one thing, when you were talking about the IoT side and having a segregated network for that, it's not always going to be the case, but some devices use things like MDNS or Bonjour protocols, so they actually kind of advertise themselves as an available service, and MDNS stands for multicast DNS. don't really need to know that it's multicast, but it's just it's broadcasting itself on that network. Usually, if you're on the same subnet, you'll see that at all times. If you're on a different subnet, so whether you're using different VLAN, different router, you won't see that at all. Some routers have the ability to turn on what's called an MDNS repeater, at which point anything that's in one subnet will then essentially get copied and passed into another subnet of your choice. So, for example, I run one that means that I can see, I've got a Chromecast, for example, that's on a segregated network because I don't want it to see other things if it doesn't have to. But at the same time, on one of the other networks that, say, my phone is on, I can actually cast to that because of the MDNS repeater software that I'm using. And as I say, it's not there for everything, and there'll be some devices that just can't do anything but broadcast. But there's at least a few things out there that you don't, you know, potentially have to jump onto another network to manage them or whatever. It's at least an option for some devices.
I was just going to mention, from the point of view of, again, sort of end user cloud engineer, and also bringing the VPN thing in. So I sort of mentioned before about only being able to access Jenkins via VPN. Well, that the reason for that is because the ingress to that machine is IP restricted, and it's IP restricted to the public IP of the VPN. So when you join the VPN, your traffic appears to come from a particular IP, as does everyone else who's logged into the VPN. And only that IP is allowed access to those to cloud resources. So that's using cloud firewall type technology. In Azure, it's NSG. In AWS, it would be security groups and so on. So that's a way of protecting. And going back to John's point about the management network, often that's just represented by a single machine, which is often known as a bastion host or a jump box or a jump host. And so that one machine has access to the other resources, and you go, so if you, it's unusual maybe in cloud, but if you want to SSH into something, you SSH through that machine, or HTTP proxy through that machine, and so on. So that is a way of protecting those machines that are in the cloud from other things.
I suppose another point to mention as well is there's something called Zero Trust, which I don't know as much about as I'd like to, but it's the concept, I think, and I could be getting this way wrong, of kind of a least privileged access, but it's public access to services. So rather than having to have VPN software, it's, say, you know, going to somewhere like GitHub or somewhere similar, but only you're able to access that because of how it authenticates. And I think it's using things like OAuth and IDC to authenticate a user, and then given that least level of privilege to be able to access the resources that they have, almost in a way like AWS's IAM and all that kind of thing to do roles at that stage. And it just means that a company doesn't necessarily need infrastructure to then be able to access something else. It means that you can access it directly while keeping a, you know, almost a security perimeter, but technically not your own security perimeter. As I say, I still don't know enough about that one at the moment. I've only delved a little bit into it, but it does seem like an interesting concept to get away from the idea of everything has to be VPN'd. It's you know, it's a way of getting away from, you know, having to have dedicated infrastructure for that.
So I've had a little bit of a look at Zero Trust, and again, it's not a particularly in-depth look, but the key things that you end up with when you're looking at Zero Trust is that you have what they refer to as attestation on the machine. So, for example, if you get the machine from your employer will put a certificate on that machine, or effectively a thing that says this machine is authorized to access resources. And that's kind of like your stage zero. You know, it's allowed to even be presented to these devices. Next, you've got your credentials. So your username, password, you may have a two-factor authentication token, like a YubiKey or a Solo key or something like that. That key kind of gives you your level one that says, not only is this machine provided by my employer or, you know, been all enrolled in the company system, but it's also an attestation that says it's my machine, whether that's biometric or something else. That kind of gives you a level one, which might get you access to the company approved antivirus product, or, you know, the company approved EDR. I can't remember what EDR stands for, but something like I'm really struggling with converting abbreviations to proper terms today. I'm sorry. But effectively, EDR is a detection product, which basically says, you know, does this user always behave in the same way? You know, do you leave large gaps between typing in the letter P and A of password? You know, things like that can be spotted. Or, you know, does the user always open up Outlook before it opens up the remote desktop product? Do you always use a remote desktop product to get to your stuff? So that's your kind of, that might be your level two thing, is, you know, that you've then got this software installed because it's part of that stage. Has it got the latest policy on it? So you'll have software that's running on the machine that can then report into a management platform. So then the next stage is you'll have what they call a CASB, a Cloud Access Security Broker. And effectively, it's like a smart proxy. So your CASB might be a cloud product from a vendor, or it might be something that's run on your cloud environment, or it might be something that runs on premises. But you effectively send all of your traffic to protected resources like O365, GitHub, AWS, all those sorts of things through your CASB. And so your cloud services that you're consuming can be configured to only permit access from your CASB service. Your CASB can interrogate the services that your antivirus or your EDR product offers to say that not only does it have the certificate you've authenticated with the right credentials, but it's also, we've got some corroboration that this is the valid user that's trying to access this service. So when the traffic's going through the CASB, the CASB can then say, I've got a 75% confidence that this is a valid user. And so therefore they can access the resources that are protected. And effectively it's a way of changing I mentioned before about the fortress model, about how, you know, all the stuff that lives inside your fortress is protected. It's kind of a way of turning that on its head. So all the cloud services are protected. You don't really trust the endpoint until you've gone through these stages of testing. There is another way of doing that that doesn't require a CASB, but I've not really seen how it works yet. Pretty much the go-to resource for the zero trust model is Google, and they've got a white paper and a series of talks about what they call the Beyond Corp. It's not a product.
Methodology?
It's kind of a... Yes. Yeah. Beyond Corp is basically their way that they do zero trust in the Google environment. A lot of the zero trust stuff is very, very hard to do, particularly if you're on a limited budget. If all that you want to do is protect a small number of resources, things like having a management environment that you VPN to and then browse down from that VPN environment, having protocol breaks, that's the key thing that I remember from the government stuff I was saying before, is SSH is not a very good protocol break. What you should really have is something like an RDP connection to a management network, because an RDP connection can't channel other traffic through it. Whereas an SSH connection, if I can SSH from my machine to a Bastion host, and then SSH from that Bastion host to something else, SSH has got this inbuilt concept of tunnels running through it. So you can tunnel another connection through that, which is really great for me as a user. You know, I can SSH to a Bastion host and then tunnel an HTTP connection through that to my router, for example. That's not so good for auditing, that if I've set up an SSH tunnel from my machine with an insecure set of parameters on my connection end, I might be exposing that forward proxy to everything in my local network, not just my local machine. So there's kind of pros and cons to that. But the protocol break of RDP is that all you can send down an RDP connection is RDP traffic. So then when you've connected to your RDP session, you've got a protocol break. So you then establish an onward connection from an SSH connection or something like that from there. And that's why RDP is perhaps a better product for your Bastion host than, say, an SSH server.
I think we've answered all the questions up, haven't we? So I think it's time.
I think so.
So Dave does our audio production. He does a wonderful job, and I think he might have his work cut out tonight because my audio has been playing up something chronic today. But have fun with that. And we're now proud members of the Otherside Podcast Network, and you can see otherside.network for more details on that.
I'd like to thank our Patreons, as I do every episode, and that is Andamo, Andy, Dave, Maha, Mike, Stu, that one, Stuart, not that one, and Yannick, the French guy from Switzerland.
Indeed, and I think it's quite clear that this show's been pretty much made up of all feedback. So if you've got feedback about this show, whether it's a positive, negative, if it's a complaint, criticism, or you just want to ask more questions about, you know, things that we're doing, please feel free to send an email to mail@adminadminpodcast.co.uk, or you can join our Telegram group. There's a link in the show notes and also on the website.
Cool. I think that's going to be a wrap then. So yeah, if you've got any questions, you can email us or join our Telegram group, and we'll see you all next time. Bye for now.
Bye. Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye. Now it's over. I can open any door. Now it's over. I don't need you anymore. Now it's over. I can open any door. Now it's over. I never needed you before.
You've been listening to a member of the Otherside Podcast Network. Find more about our shows at otherside.network.